Baz Luhrmann brilliantly floods our senses with arresting sights and sounds. That's Richard Roper of Chicago Sun-Times, his review of Baz Luhrmann's Elvis, which is our featured review this week here on Cinephile. In addition to that, other new film, Lightyear, massive film for the kids. And as far as our old movie is concerned, Mr. Broadway himself, that's me. I went and took my wife for her birthday to go see Beetlejuice on Broadway. That's the fourth Broadway show I've seen in 5 weeks. We're gonna have a theatrical podcast coming soon here to Metalark. We'll talk about the film Beetlejuice and the musical Beetlejuice. And we got great guests. Dexter Fletcher, who is awesome. He is the director of the first two episodes of The Offer. He is our wild card and the executive producer of that show. He's got stories about Miles Teller, The Godfather, Robert Evans, Matthew Good, Al Pacino. He's boys with Pacino. He actually worked with him on the film Revolution way back in 1985. And we've got an unbelievable guest, Cody.
You are burying the lead, my friend. We have a guest of all guests. The biggest guest in Cinephile history. There, I said it.
Wow. I think the best you can phrase is this. If you were to talk to one person about Elvis, who would it be? This is the best guest that you could get, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to get into Elvis and all things Elvis in just a second. But first, worlds colliding. My first friend at ESPN, the great Jordan Kahana, we started together May 3rd, 2010, rookie camp, which is what they call it at ESPN, your first couple days, their big orientation. I remember we both started freaking out. We saw Bob Lee in the kitchen. I'm like, oh my God, it's Bob Lee.
Oh.
He texted me and goes, I'm going to see your boy Cody. I'm like, what? Sheets and giggles sending you to the Stanley Cup Final Game 5. And it was a lovely picture he sent me. It was Cody, Jordan, and Roy together enjoying the Stanley Cup Final. What an experience.
It was a three-day trip there. Jordan was like our liaison. He like Ubered us everywhere, took us out to eat. Sheets and Giggles is paying for the whole bill. We're eating, you know, Ocean Prime. We're like eating good and going around, having a good time. No, Jordan was really cool. The trip was great. Sheets and Giggles hooked it up like always. We didn't get to see the clinching game. But game five, man, Denver, that atmosphere, not the weed. I'm not talking about the weed. I'm talking about the hockey. But I'm telling you, it was just really like the atmosphere was like nothing I'd ever seen in a hockey. Obviously, it's a clinching scenario, so they're going to be hyped. But it was a really fun game despite they lost.
I enjoyed following it on social media because you were commenting on Roy firing back on tweets. So you got to see Roy in action. He just loves crushing people.
Roy on Twitter is a thing. Like Roy's different. He's a different beast on Twitter and in person. And it's just usually you just see the tweets pop up. It's very rare you're on a 40-minute train ride with Roy just kind of looking over his shoulder and getting to see the man in action. And it is like you think he's just, you know, willy-nilly with this stuff. No. He's doing research. He's looking up things before tweets. He's writing out long tweets and then deleting it, just being like thinking better of it. Like, I'm not going to send this. Like, I did like an hour of reporting on this. And there was, I know people say like, he does the Yo Mama stuff. So Roy
can sometimes get a lot of mama stuff. Yes, he's always commenting on
people's
mothers.
He can get a bad rap, but I'm telling you, he researches. He's thoughtful. And I was impressed with Twitter Roy. I'm not going to lie.
I also like the clip of you on Instagram in which you were talking about the fact that things are going well at home because you've been asking your wife about it her day, and you're very specific. You'll ask about coworkers and such.
Right. You add, like, that's something I said on the Levitard show. Like, you need to, if you just say, how's your day 10 days in a row with nothing else, your wife's going to catch on to, he doesn't really give a shit. You got to think of some key words, some key names, some names she mentions a lot, and ask how they're doing. How's Sarit? Oh, she's good?
Yeah, Sarit was the one. Yeah. I was impressed by that. And then they try to mock you. They try to make you sound like a caveman. You go, actually, I'm the one cooking, just to be clear here. Like, I'm domestic, Chris.
Right. They tried to attack me on that. It's like, ask her what's for dinner. It's like, no, actually, she asked me for what's for dinner. So let's not come at me at that.
One thought for you, because everyone knows and loves Greg Cody. People are not as familiar with my dad, Papa Virk, who is visiting right now, my mom and my dad. I have a thought for you about your father, because I'm a little bit concerned about my dad and how much he's sleeping. How much does your dad sleep at night? First of all, how old is Greg Cody?
My dad is born in 54, so 67, right? 68?
Okay.
Yeah, something like that.
How much does he sleep?
He sleeps. My dad is, he's kind of a night owl. My dad goes to bed at like 11:30 and is up probably sleeps like 8 hours.
Okay, so the usual men, I would think. My dad out at 9, up at 7. I go, wow, that's a solid 10-hour slumber.
I mean, yeah, he's probably, how old is he?
He's 76. He's turning 76. Okay. His birthday this week. We're going to Jersey Shore. And then gets a nap at 4.
I go, hey, oh, God, wow.
So 10 hours a night and a nap, 11 hours. And when went to at noon, I go, hey, are we at 2 naps now? 12 hours a day.
My uncle, my dad's, believe it or not, it's possible to have this. My dad's older brother is he's like 9 years older than my dad. So he's like in his upper 70s, maybe even 80s now. The hell, whatever. And he goes to bed. He literally goes to bed at 6 a.m. I mean, at 6 p.m. and is up at like 4 a.m.
Awful.
He's a lifetime bachelor. And like, he doesn't have any kids, no responsibilities. So he's like tired at 6 p.m., wakes up at like 4 a.m. and goes on Facebook. So my uncle is always like Facebooking at like 5 a.m. every morning. It's like hilarious.
That's actually an unbelievable revel. I would have thought lifelong bachelor, he goes to bed at 2 a.m. and he gets up at 10 a.m. I go, okay, no, that's fine. But I don't know. He's going the other way. He's like, I'm exhausted. No. I got no one to talk to. I got no kids. Screw it. I'm going to bed.
And his, like, when you ask him why he does it, he goes, I'm bored. Like, I got nothing. I live my day. By 6 p.m., I've eaten dinner. I'm just like, yeah, I've watched everything. I'm just going to bed.
Okay. Well,
Dick Cody, ladies and gentlemen. Uncle Dick Cody.
Uncle Dick Cody. We got to get him trending right now on Twitter, or at least a shout out on Instagram. Well, it was not Uncle Dick, but it was Mama Virk and Papa Virk looking after my kids while my wife and I snuck out to go see Elvis. And I was so excited to see this film. My wife loves Baz Luhrmann, who is the director, the co-writer, and the co-producer. Fans of Cinephile will remember for Valentine's Day, I took her to go see Moulin Rouge on Broadway, which is a very famous Baz Luhrmann film, arguably his best film. And now we're getting our Baz on once again. It's all about Elvis. Here's the story from his childhood in Tupelo, Mississippi, to his rise to stardom starting in Memphis, Tennessee, and his conquering of Las Vegas, Nevada, Elvis Presley becomes the first rock and roll star and changes the world with his music. Now, somebody tweeted me, because I had already posted, hey, my review's coming, of, and they said, is it, I mean, I just don't like Baz. And here's the thing, the director, he's very much a love it or hate it kind of director, and that is worst, I suppose, you would say he is all style and no substance. So if you're unfamiliar with his filmography, Moulin Rouge, which I watched earlier this year, Romeo and Juliet, the DiCaprio version, came out in 1996. John Leguizamo, I believe, playing Montague or Capulet, one of those guys. He also made The Great Gatsby with Leonardo DiCaprio. His biggest bomb was Australia, just a disaster with Hugh Jackman and Nicole Kidman. But he's very much a love it or hate it type of director. But I think with Elvis, he finds the perfect sensibility and the perfect subject matter for his tastes, which are big and bold and brassy. And I'll get this out of the way right now. Elvis is the first great film I've seen of 2022. I absolutely loved it. I thought it was a star-making performance by Austin Butler. And one of the keys to the movie is this. I didn't recognize almost any of the cast. The only recognizable name is Tom Hanks, who I'll get to in a second. But Austin Butler, I believe he's done some stuff with Nickelodeon or Disney.
Yeah, he was like in Hannah Montana.
So I'm not familiar with this man's filmography at all. So as I'm watching the movie, he's just completely, to me, Elvis. He looks like he's completely immersed in the role. He is, you know, impeccably dressed. The wardrobe is fantastic. This has to get nominated for an Academy Award for costume design, if not production design, the cinematography, the glitz and the glamour. But just his face, he's impeccably handsome, and his dancing is unbelievable. I mean, when he first shakes, rattles, and rolls, you've got Tom Hanks in the narration as Colonel Tom Parker, who is his agent, and he says, in that moment, I saw a star being born, the first time he starts jiggling his hips, and I felt, as a moviegoer, I saw a star being born on the screen. I said, wow, Austin Butler, this is a true star-making performance. That first scene where he starts wiggling out like Elvis, and the entire movie is just captivated. I just thought he had undeniable charisma in the film.
Is that I heard, and it's just Mike Ryan I heard talking about it. Mike Ryan saw the movie, and he was positive on it, but he said the beginning was a little, like, it took, like, he wasn't sure he liked it at the beginning.
Yeah, well, the thing with Baz Luhrmann's films, again, it's very impressionistic, which is to say, it's not a by-the-book biopic. You know, the by-the-book one is here he is born, here he is when he's 6, 7, 8. He gets touched by music, he becomes a musician, he goes to the big city, etc. Like, Luhrmann's movies are much more impressionistic, which is to say, there might be a 10-minute scene of young Elvis just being surrounded by black musicians and soaking it all in. And, you know, he's talking to, you know, B.B. King, or he's being influenced by Little Richard. A bop, bop, a loo, bop, a wop, bop, bop, saw a girl, name Sue. So I guess I kind of understand what Mike's saying is that it's not a conventional biopic. It's kind of just immersive in that world. And I did think at first, you know, kind of remind me a little bit in an odd way of the film Casino, because Casino has a lot of voiceover in the first hour. It's a lot of Robert De Niro explaining the way that Las Vegas works. And in that movie, it works because the first hour almost feels like a documentary, and then it goes more into the relationship between De Niro, Pesci, and of course Sharon Stone. So similarly, this movie starts out with Colonel Tom Parker. It's Tom Hanks's character. You don't actually see Elvis until the 13-minute mark. It's Colonel Tom narrating his life and his life with Elvis. And you say, wait, I don't want to see a Colonel Tom Parker movie. I want to see an Elvis movie. So thankfully, Baz starts to shift the attention away. But I think it's his entry point. It's his way of telling the story through a different character. You know, it's like in Schindler's List, yeah. rather than tell the story of the Jews being persecuted, you have the story of Oscar Schindler, Liam Neeson, and his impact upon them, and then you see all the atrocities. So similarly, it's, you know, Tom Hanks as Colonel Tom Parker is the window into Elvis. The first 10 minutes, like I said, voiceover looking back at his life, etc. Boom, now we get Elvis, young Elvis, away we go. But to Mike's point, I guess, the first 45 minutes I thought really moved. I thought the pacing was excellent. Really just had, the thing about Baz Luhrmann's films, again, it's all style, no substance. So at times, I kind of wish he would take a breath and give me a little bit of depth to something. He just kind of takes the moment and runs with it. But the good news is it's never boring and it's never dull because he's got way too much meat to kind of cook on the bone here. So I would say the first 45 minutes is moving. After that, about 10 minutes, I might have looked. My wife was on her phone. She loves texting. Don't know, whatever. Okay, one time. Okay, it's hour. And then I would say I didn't even look at the watch. Like I thought the second half was outstanding. I mean, it really hit its groove. It's a 2.5 hour film. And I would say I did not look at the watch or didn't look at her looking at her watch for the last hour, 15 minutes. Just I thought the pacing was breathless. And it really then dove into the substance of Elvis. So like I said, the first section is about the style and the music, how influenced he is by black music. But once you kind of get into the guts of who Elvis was, you know, his love, his passions, his relationship with Priscilla, his daughter Lisa Marie, and how everything became so complicated with the Colonel, who was this very dark, mysterious character, very enigmatic, then I thought the film really hit home. And I thought particularly the ending is incredibly impactful. I mean, the final 10 minutes are just purely emotional. And, you know, I've heard people tweeting and talking and say they were in tears watching the rest of that film. It is gorgeously rendered, I will say, particularly the final 10 minutes of the movie.
Are they touching the drugs a lot?
They are hitting the drugs. This is the thing. The movie is endorsed by the Elvis family, so I think that's always tricky. It reminds me of the documentary, which I was not as enamored of others, The Last Dance, because as I said, it was a hagiography, which is to say it's just Michael Jordan having his imprint on everything, and he's just telling his life the way he tells it, and it's all his version. So as Ken Burns himself said, because that's not a documentary. That's just one guy telling his life. So when the Elvis family gave their permission, you're like, okay, are they going to want a sanitized version of the movie? Which credit to Elton John, when he had the rights, obviously, to Rocketman, but he told the director, and you'll listen to the interview, by the way, coming up, Dexter Fletcher, who was great, who directed Rocketman. Elton John said, put it all in there. Like, put the sex, put the bisexuality, put the drugs, put the cheating. Like, that's my life. Like, do what you want to do. Like, that's how it's going to be. So I don't know what restrictions the Elvis estate put upon Baz Luhrmann. I don't think they did at all, because they certainly show him taking pills and being inducted by the drugs. But I like the fact they didn't harp on it. I think people know that. And again, this is a film probably for Elvis lovers and those who don't know a ton about Elvis. I think it's a good indoctrination of the world of Elvis. Again, the familiar beats, influenced by black music from Mississippi, huge thing in Vegas, the Colonel screws him, some drugs, love, the hips, etc. But I don't think it's not like, you know, it's not like Trainspotting. There's not like 30 minutes of him getting on drugs. But yes, you definitely see him being impacted by the pills. Now, I'm giving the film 3.5 maple leaves. I want to give it 4 maple leaves. Like I said, it's the first great film I've seen this year. It's the best film I've seen so far. We're 6 months into the year. The one quibble I have is with our man, Tom Hanks. Listen, he is one of the greatest actors alive, and I appreciate his challenge in this movie because he's playing the villain, the Colonel. For those who don't know, he ripped off Elvis something fierce. 50% he was taking. 50-50 was the split between the artist and the agent / manager when it came to grosses and merchandising and licensing. And as the Colonel is narrating the life, he's like, and you know, he's got this really ridiculous accent. And he's saying, you know, hey, I'm the one who made Elvis. I'm the one who brought him to this. I took care of my boy, etc. But he's just ripped the guy off. It was horrific what he did to him. And it makes you think about all these musicians who have been impacted by financial woes and financial miscarriages. Now, Hanks does his best, but I can never get away from the fact I'm looking at Tom Hanks just drowning in latex. Like, it's just a giant fat suit, and he's got this crazy accent. So I just would have preferred it, because the rest of the cast is all anonymous. Like, the rest of them, I've never seen any of these actors, so I'm completely buying them as Elvis's brother, Elvis's daughter, Elvis's wife, etc. But this, I had the constant feeling that I was watching Tom Hanks doing an odd accent and just in a fat suit playing Colonel Tom Parker. So I give him credit for taking the role. And listen, we all know why he did it, because Baz Luhrmann's not going to get this film financed without at least one star. I mean, you can't make a film. Austin Butler, nobody knows who he is. Okay, well, how is the studio going to finance it? We got Tom Hanks. Really? You got Tom Hanks? Okay, great. I watched the film. I said the budget must have been $100 million. I checked, $85 million. So a lot of that is getting bankrolled by the fact Tom Hanks is in your film and you can sell that worldwide distribution, etc. Which gets us to the financial aspect of it. I was really cheering on the film this weekend without even having seen it, because I said so many of these Hollywood movies are superheroes and sequels and kids' movies all summer. Like, God forbid, this is actually an original film about a very famous subject. I hope it does well at the box office. So I checked with bated breath after seeing the film Sunday night, and sure enough, Elvis number one at the box office in a tie with Top Gun. Both films opened at $30.5 million. So Top Gun is in its fifth weekend, which has shown incredible legs. I mean, it's made now $1 billion at the box office. First Tom Cruise film to make $1 billion. But Elvis opened at 30.5. And I'm telling my wife, and I go, that's a huge achievement. Think about this. The only thing people are seeing these days are freaking Jurassic World and Tom Cruise and garbage. Like, for an original film with an anonymous star as the lead, that's massive. 30.5.
Yeah, but Elvis, it's Elvis, right? That's the star.
But Elvis not exactly big with the kids. Like, I can't imagine any 18 to 34 year olds going, hey, I can't wait to go see Elvis this weekend.
Yeah, but I'm 35 years old, and like, so I'm just, I guess, out of that demographic. But like, I'm interested in it just because Elvis is like, I get maybe the low, maybe like 20 year olds and 18 year olds don't have this, but my
people
generation
on TikTok are not doing Elvis videos.
My generation, Elvis is like, that's, you know what I mean? It's like Elvis, like nice. That's, so like, I don't, maybe you're right about, I'm getting to the point where I'm now not young anymore. So like, like maybe
the fact
you're right.
No longer the 18 to 34 is tough. Like, that's right. A tough, but like, that's the
average. I can't speak for like kids graduating high school and college right now. So maybe you're right. Maybe those kids don't want to go see Elvis.
They're thinking of fat Elvis and peanut butter and banana sandwiches and that stuff.
Yeah. Now, and I'm just picturing like Tom Hanks playing Fat Bastard, by the way. When you like, that's what I'm envisioning in my mind.
Yeah. Another bad accent, big fat suit. Tom Hanks would be amazing. But to your point, it is Elvis in that you know you're going to have a huge built-in audience. This guy is the number one recording artist ever. Like, it's amazing. Yeah. They have the crawl at the end there, which made me think about Mount Rushmore of male singers. I'll throw this out at you now. Elvis is obviously number one. My guy, Sinatra. I mean, listen, his nickname was The Voice. Gotta have Sinatra. That's number two. All right, Johnny Cash. Hello, I'm Johnny Cash. And I think four, noted pedophile Michael Jackson.
Like, yeah, I was going to say.
Like, I mean, you're not topping those four guys as male artists in the last 100 years?
I'm glad you brought up Michael Jackson because I was feeling a little squeamish about doing it, but I think if you're just talking about, I mean, he's got to be on there.
Yeah, but the music of Elvis is amazing. And again, credit to Baz Luhrmann when he's doing the movie together. He never goes more than, I'm going to say, 30 seconds to a minute on any of the songs. Like, it was funny. At one point, my wife started to get so pumped up. They played Burning Love. I'm like, here we go. And it's like, he'll do one bar. Boom, cut to the next thing. I'm like, man, his pacing is, he probably said to himself, I'm not going to make a 4-hour movie, and I've got to jam all this stuff in 2.5 hours. Go, go, go. So, again, at times, I would have liked, like, I did not to hear It's Now or Never. I would have liked a little more of a little less conversation.
But I kind of want to have 30 seconds of a bunch of Elvis songs.
Ultimately, Elvis is a fascinating character. I think of the movie Pulp Fiction. Tarantino has a deleted scene in which Uma Thurman, Mia Wallace, is telling John Travolta, she goes, you're either a Beatles person or an Elvis person. And she goes, no, you can like Elvis and like the Beatles, and you can like the Beatles and like Elvis. But ultimately, one or the other, you're picking one or the other. And she looks at him and says, now, obviously, I'm not going to have the conversation with you because I know you are clearly an Elvis man. And Tarantino himself is an Elvis man. I believe he played an Elvis impersonator early in his career before he became Reservoir Dogs writer, director, Quentin Tarantino. He wanted to be an actor. Remember, he played an Elvis impersonator. So the question is, Chris Cody, are you an Elvis man or are you a Beatles man?
I'm a Beatles guy. If you made me choose.
Let it be.
I've delved into the Beatles library where I have not, like, I know the hits. Like, I know all the songs that, like, you know, we're going to, like, all the songs we might hear in a little bit. Like, I know them all.
Right.
That's what I was doing, by the way, when I said I'm in the mood to hear 30 seconds of a bunch of Elvis songs. I was trying to give you a nice little transition
into our Elvis. We're about to get to our start here in a second. But ultimately, I think it's an excellent film. I'm glad that it's a hit. I think it's going to make at least $100 million. When you look at musical biopics, if a movie can hit $30 million out of the gate, that's a good sign. You look at Rocket Man, look at Walk the Line, you look at Mamma Mia 2, for God's sakes. It's a good sign that people, and again, it's an older demographic. Like, the Elvis audience is going to be 35 plus, 40 plus. If they're going back to movies, that's a good sign. And I hope the film is certainly recognized for Austin Butler's superb performance. And like I said, the costume design, the music, the production design, really, really well done. A little less conversation for me. It's now time for a huge get. So those are my thoughts on the film Elvis, and we've been racking our brain trying to get a big guest. Director Baz Luhrmann, Tom Hanks, Austin Butler, Lisa Marie Presley. You know, we got the biggest guest out there. If you wanted to talk about the movie Elvis with anybody, who would it be? It would be Elvis. Elvis, thanks for joining us right now on Cinephile.
You ain't nothing but a hound dog, crying all the time. Well, you ain't never caught a rabbit. You ain't no friend of mine. You ain't nothing but a hound dog.
Baby, Elvis is in the house. Elvis, it's great to see you.
All right.
Obviously, it was a tragic ending to your life story, but I love that you're back now. I love the film. I thought it was brilliant. What did you think of it?
Well, thank you for having me. I got paid before the podcast, so you're lucky it even came out after that, I tell you. But I thought the movie was great. I thought they really portrayed me good. I thought that the girls were much prettier, though, I tell you. That's what I really liked. But
the girls much prettier in the film than they actually were in life.
Yes.
Look out now.
What did you think about Austin Butler? I mean, Austin Butler's playing you. I mean, to have a guy actually playing you, what did you think? Did the kid do you justice? You're the king.
Absolutely. He was tall. He had slender. The suits looked good. He talked like me. His hair was like me. So I hope you guys, both Elvis fans before the movie?
I am. I'm a huge Elvis fan. I took my wife to go see the film, and we loved it. I just thought it was really authentic and captured the essence of Elvis, and it was sad, you know, the relationship with the Colonel. I mean, the Colonel really screwed you, Elvis. I really feel bad what the Colonel did to you.
How has Elvis managed with, like, Zoom and technology? How's Elvis doing with that stuff?
Well, you saw how I was fumbling around with Zoom trying to get you, but...
yeah, I mean, a couple switch, but we got there.
But it's good because it's spreading the word, especially a movie like this really spreads the word, reignites what Elvis was about, why it connected with everybody.
All right, one song that was not in the film, which is one of my favorites, is It's Now or Never. So I'll give you a choice here, Elvis. Either you can give me a little bit of It's Now or Never, or my other two favorites, Burning Love and A Little Less Conversation. Your choice, one of those three.
It's now or never, come hold me tight. Kiss me, my darling, I'll be mine tonight. Let me see you do your lip.
Yeah, be mine.
And the other one is A Little Less Conversation, which they actually did a remake of that and did a little commercial with that. A little less conversation, a little more action. All this aggravation and satisfaction in me. A little more bite, a little less spark. A little less fight, a little more spark. Close your mouth and open up your heart and maybe satisfy me.
Satisfy me.
There you go. You got it.
Okay, last one, Burning Love.
Lord Almighty, I feel my temperature rising. Yeah, higher and higher. It's burning through to my soul. Yeah.
Yes. You can't beat it. Elvis has been revealed as Dan Cunningham. He is a great sport. He's a great guy. If you love what Dan just brought as Elvis, and I'm sure you did, Dan, where can people find you on social media? Where can they book you? Give us the whole full detail.
Well, thank you so much. You can find me on Instagram as Dan as Elvis. And you can find me on The Bash, my website, BASH, The Bash. Just look under Dan Cunningham, and you can see all the videos and all the reviews and comments. And I'd love to meet you. Do a show for you.
You need to look out now for all the requests.
Thank you very much, brother. Love you guys. You guys are great.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So how did that go?
Well, listen, you had texted me Sunday night and said, I've got a huge guest for Elvis. Who's the one person you'd want to speak to? And I said, well, obviously, Lisa Marie Presley, his daughter.
And, I was like, I'm trying to get Lisa Marie, but who's option B?
I was hoping Baz Luhrmann or Tom Hanks or Austin Butler. But no, it was actually Elvis. So I'm like, all right, we're in. Let's do it.
That went exactly how I wanted it to go. My man, Elvis.
He's definitely a great guy. I hope everyone supports Dan. And Dan is Elvis. The best thing about him was once we hate, like, you know, it's like snapping the fingers. It's like with any sort of impersonator. Hey, do this, do this, do this. Monkey see, monkey do. He nailed it.
Oh, yeah.
I could have asked him any song. He would have nailed it. Next time, Hound Dog. He'll do it.
I just wanted to get in my, look out now. That's it. That's all I got.
One big spoiler from the movie, by the way, there is no mention of thank you very much, which I would think is the most often.
Really?
Often, if somebody said do an Elvis impression, I'd say thank you very much. Not once in the movie. But there is one time they say Elvis has left the building, which I did like.
My Elvis impression is just Jack White in Dewey Cox. That's
walk hard. Yes.
Walk hard. Look out now. All right.
All right, let's do another new movie here. Lightyear, not nearly as exciting as Elvis. While spending years attempting to return home, maroon space ranger Buzz Lightyear encounters an army of ruthless robots commanded by Zurg who are attempting to steal his fuel source. It's a long way of saying it's not as good as the other ones, okay? I'll tell you that right now. Toy Story 3, the best of the Toy Story crew. Dan Stanzik will approve. Toy Story 4 was okay, but Lightyear just feels like a cash grab, okay? And first and foremost, why is it not Tim Allen as the voice of Buzz? I like Chris Evans. I couldn't get behind Chris Evans as Buzz. And the argument, the poor argument Angus McLean tried to give, the co-writer and director, was, well, you know, he's the voice of the toy, Tim Allen. This is an origin story about Buzz. This is his actual voice as an actual person. I go, don't give me that nonsense. You didn't want to give Tim Allen $60 million, so you gave Chris Evans $5 million, and that's the story, right? Just be honest.
So the context, I'm thank you for saying that. So the context of this is the story that they created the action figure, right? Like, yeah. I was trying to figure out the correlation, like how they were going to, like, do that. So I was just like, that makes sense now. Okay, good.
This is who Buzz Lightyear actually was. And I'm just, listen, it feels like watered down Pixar. Pixar is normally fantastic, and this feels like run-of-the-mill, generic Pixar. It's the first one we've had in a few years, actually back in movie theaters, right? Turning Red was available via streaming Disney Plus along with Luca. So they actually have a Pixar movie back in theaters. I mean, I paid an outrageous amount of money. We had to go IMAX. It was the only time it was showing. So that was $81 for me and four kids. And the snacks was 30. I paid $120 to go see Lightyear. Thank God I got rid of Peacock, by the way, this month. That saved me another $5. So DirecTV, I chopped her down. Peacock, there's another $5 gone. $120 for Lightyear. I would agree with this performance. Shubhra Gupta of the Indian Express. The Chris Evans film has little soul, spark, and moving moments. And Wendy Eyed of The Observer. For a film which shoots for the stars, this is disappointingly pedestrian stuff. I'll give it 2 Maple Leafs. This is the furthest thing from Infinity and beyond.
Pretty predictable, right? Yeah.
Exactly. Lastly, let's talk about Beetlejuice. Listen, I love the film. This is an excuse, though, more to talk about the musicals. I took my wife to go see it. $375 for tickets, which is $290. Dinner for two, halal food truck, lamb over rice, that's $20. Parking, $35 for New York City, not bad on a Tuesday night. And the snacks, which was critical. My wife started falling asleep, end of the first act, a long day with the kids. I'm like, oh my God, I gotta get snacks. Intermission show, I'm like, all right, give me whatever you have. I'll take a Diet Coke, I'll take M&M's, I'll take Twizzlers. $30. $30 for M&M's, Twizzlers, and a Diet Coke.
That is the that might be the biggest ripoff in the history of vending.
Think about stadium food, and you go, oh my God, I paid $8 for a burger. It was a pretty good burger, though. And I'm at a ball game, whatever, $10 beer, right? No, this is the worst one ever. $30, M&M's, Twizzlers, and a Diet Coke. I'm like, I go, this is larceny. You're already ripping me off for the tickets. This is outrageous.
Wild.
Fourth Broadway show in 5 months, and this ranked fourth in the ones that I've seen. Like, I loved American Buffalo, loved Mammoth, Sam Rockwell, Lawrence Fishburne. Moulin Rouge, surprisingly, was excellent. Really enjoyed it.
Mr. Saturday Night.
My boy, Billy Crystal, great. Billy, listen, I believe it's if you try to get tickets right now after the Tony Awards, it's sold out. I'm not kidding, right? Because you were mocking his performance.
It's because of that thing he did at the Tonys. Yeah, they're like, we got to see this live. I need to go, hey, when he says, hey, I need to.
Today Tix, which is the app that I use. If you go on there right now, if you type in Mr. Saturday Night, because the show's not available. Almost any other show, I can go there, click on, boom, 20% off, 30% off. Mr. Saturday Night, selling out. People want to see it, just because that's how strong Billy Crystal's performance was. But anyways, Beetlejuice, it's tough to match the original. The film I love. I mean, the film is one of my favorites. Tim Burton directing. The spirits of a deceased couple are harassed by an unbearable family that has moved into their home and hire a malicious spirit to drive them out. The movie stars Alec Baldwin, Gina Davis, Academy Award winner, and then you've got, you know, pieces of Michael Keaton, who is incredible as Beetlejuice. I mean, who doesn't love Michael Keaton? And you've got Winona Ryder, who's amazing. Jeffrey Jones, the great Canadian, Catherine O'Hara. The movie is special because it's, like I said, a little bit of Beetlejuice. He's a supporting character. The musical is all Beetlejuice. And I'm like, oh, so this is one of those examples where the supporting character becomes the star. And to me, that doesn't work as effectively. Now, again, if you're into musical theater, I think it's an entertaining time. I didn't think the actress playing Lydia was as strong as the other actors, but I appreciate seeing a show on Broadway. The songs are generally upbeat and infectious and dark and obviously making fun of the fact that they're all part of the deceased. But when it comes to Beetlejuice, I would give the theatrical review, I would say it was a good musical, but pales in comparison to the other three I've seen. The movie, though, is exceptional for Maple Leafs. If somehow you have not seen Beetlejuice, do yourself a favor. I just watched, by the way, on 60 Minutes, the great L. John Wertheim, locked into tennis. Wimbledon begins this week. John's the best tennis writer alive. He also is a 60 Minutes correspondent. He did an interview with Michael Keaton from a few months ago, and they re-aired it. My dad, while he was not sleeping, I said, "Dad, have you seen this one?" He goes, "No, he loves 60 Minutes. Favorite show on TV." I'm like, "Michael Keaton's amazing." So I watched it again, and they were talking to Michael Keaton about all his performances and Batman and all the rest of it. And I just love, that scene in Beetlejuice, when he first meets Alec Baldwin and Gina Davis, is amazing. Because he goes, "What are your qualifications?" He goes, "Well, I attended Juilliard. I mean, I've seen The Exorcist 170 times, and it keeps getting funnier every single time I see it. Now, do you think I'm qualified?" He goes, "Oh, what we mean is, can you be scary?" He's like, "Oh, what do you think of this?" The snakes come out. And that moment where finally Lydia, one of the writers, says Beetlejuice three times, he goes, "It's showtime." Can't beat it. The movie is
That's one of those classic movies that I've seen. Like, I've watched that movie probably multiple times, but I was young when I watched it. So I need to watch that again. I bet you there's a bunch of those a bunch of moments where I would be like, "Oh, I never even noticed that part before," because I was young.
I think you'd love it. If you watched it now, you'd be like, "This is a great movie." I mean, it's so inventive and visually dazzling and dark and funny. And the music.
The dinner scene. Like, I think back, my first thought is the dinner scene and everybody just acting all weird. And
I think that's the two. Somebody said to you Beetlejuice, and the first thing you think of is Michael Keaton, and you probably think of dinner scene Deo, the Banana Boat song by Harry Belafonte. And Catherine dancing.
Deo.
Daylight come and go home. Thankfully, that was in the musical, and I love the song "Shake, Shake, Shake, Sonora," which is the end of the movie. No writers' day. You got the football players dancing and all the rest of it. So, anyways, watch the movie, watch the musical if you can, and make sure you watch Elvis. It's a great film, and I hope everyone enjoyed it. I hope everyone enjoyed Dan as Elvis. Now it's time for our special guest. We've been talking a lot about The Offer, Matthew Good, amazing as Robert Evans. Let's talk to the man who directed him in the first two episodes of The Offer. Here is Dexter Fletcher. Well, you've heard my thoughts here on The Offer here on Cinephile, how much I've enjoyed this limited series available on Paramount Plus. It has wrapped up all 10 episodes, but if you haven't seen it yet, you should watch it. And if you have seen it, go watch it again. It's a pleasure to bring in Dexter Fletcher right now, one of the executive producers and director of the show as well for the first couple episodes. Dexter, thank you so much. First and foremost, congratulations on a wonderful achievement. How daunting a challenge was this? The Godfather, arguably the greatest American film ever made, and you're telling the story behind the scenes of this iconic film.
Yeah, well, since you put it like that, now I'm terrified. I never thought about it before. I thought I was just having a good time. No, look, I mean, you're right. It is one of arguably the greatest films of certainly the last half century, and iconic and seminal. And so that wasn't lost on any of us, really, and certainly not me and the cast going in. And the writers, Michael Tolkien and Nicky Toscano. But I think what we quickly convinced ourselves of was that we were telling the story behind this great film and that we weren't trying to replicate it or we couldn't do that. It's too amazing. But what we could do was send it a love letter. What we could do was kind of enjoy and celebrate the people who did create that film and from that period and give it all our sort of heart and admiration that we possibly could, really. We just wanted to make sure that we kind of, gave it our best in that regard.
Everyone's got a version of their own story, whether it's Francis Ford Coppola or Robert Evans. I believe for The Offer, Al Ruddy was the main source of inspiration for Michael Tolkien. How did that come to be? How did Al's story be the story that ended up being the one that was told?
You know, that's interesting. I'm not sure how they met or what the genesis of that was. But certainly Michael Tolkien and Al Ruddy, who is the sole producer of The Godfather, he's the man with his name on the Academy Award that sits on his shelf. He's the sole producer. He's this kind of maverick from back in the 70s that produced some great films and came from the background of he created Hogan's Heroes, which is a great show that everybody knows. But I think he and Michael sat down and just started recounting his memories of that period, of what happened, who was involved, and sort of like how the whole film got made. And Tolkien dramatized those memoirs, really, those conversations.
Yeah, and it's amazing because I think in many ways he's an underrated and underappreciated figure in history. People would know about Marlon Brando and Al Pacino and Coppola and Evans, but Al Ruddy, and I like the fact you included in the show, later won an Academy Award producing $1 Million Baby. So he had a great relationship with Clint Eastwood as well.
Yeah, which still stands to this day. He was one of part of the producing team that worked on Cry Macho, I believe. You know, yes. So they're still great friends to this day, and are, you know, the mavericks that they are, like I say. And Al's an incredible character, and has many, many stories. You know, when we were trying to land Miles Teller, who's fantastically plays him fantastic throughout the 10 episodes, you know, Miles had a big decision to make. You know, Top Gun was about to come out, and he was doing some great movie stuff, and this was a big undertaking for 6-7 months of his life on this 10-part series. And I don't know quite what Al Ruddy said to him, but after a conversation that was meant to be sort of half an hour, after 2 hours later, you know, Miles hung up with him and he called me immediately and said, "I'm doing it. I'm in. I must play this guy. He's unbelievable." You know, so Ruddy has this incredible charm and power and presence that Miles really imbibed and kind of plays beautifully and carries the whole series with. He's really quite masterful at it.
Yeah, Miles is a terrific actor. I really enjoyed his work. I've been on podcast previously. And I think in many ways, you know, he has to be the grounded center of the show, right? It's not a showy lead performance, but it's critical because he's the one holding the whole thing together. There's been some comparisons to some critics. He's kind of like Robert Mitchum. Do you see that connection? All Mitchum, one of my favorites.
Yeah, I'm sure Miles would adore that. I'm sure he'd really love that. You know, yeah, look, there's a certain amount of old school macho Hollywood about Miles that is really, you know, not out of place. And somehow he's very current as well at the same time. He's not anachronistic. You know, that's the great thing. He stands up and is counted as the guy that he is. And I think that it's his equal part of any other kind of diverse kind of cast that we have. And we do have a very wide range of characters, but Miles really is the tentpole. He's the guy who allows all those larger-than-life characters to stay grounded. You know, the Bob Evanses, you know, Matthew Good is particularly big, kind of wide role and fantastic performance. Charlie Bluedhorn, you know, who owned Paramount at the time, Bern Gorman, and even Mario Puzo, and you know, Patrick Gallo and Coppola. These characters allowed by Miles' really central performance, and Juno Temple as his right-hand woman, there helps allow them to really fill out the space with their characters and really, you know, color it.
Let's talk further about my favorite part of the show, which you just mentioned. Matthew Good is Robert Evans. I mean, yeah, he is just fabulous. From the first time you see him, and Dexter, I love The Kid Stays in the Picture. I have the book. I've seen the documentary.
Right.
Anybody who's a movie geek knows what a great character Robert Evans is. Love story, The Godfather, Chinatown. And I thought Matthew Good just knocked it out of the park. Tell me everything about Matthew Good playing this role, because I thought he was tremendous.
Well, he was. And, you know, it's no secret, really, that he sort of came late in the day. There was a big name movie star who was toying with playing it and didn't. And so Matthew was top of the list of, right, if the big name movie star doesn't do it, who do you want? And Nicky Toscano and myself, Nicky the showrunner, we were both really adamant that Matthew was being the guy. And Matthew didn't even know about it. I mean, I think we just offered him the job, really. And it came as a complete surprise to him. And he was in London and he was locked down on COVID. And all the other actors were here in LA. And I was doing rehearsals and had got everyone together, and Matthew was sort of in a vacuum and created that character sort of on his own. He and I were speaking a lot, obviously, but I think that kind of helps him in a way, because Evans sort of inhabits his own space in this story. As a driving force and the sort of godhead, if you like, of the studio who allowed all things and made things happen. And Matthew's process was really intense and quite solitary, really, because it had to be. But he studied and studied. And what he's done brilliantly is he's not created an impression or a snapshot. He's created a very fully well-rounded character that goes through so many different emotions and moments in the show. From when you meet him, you know, you really go on this fantastic journey with him. And it's a testament, really, to his great acting talent and skill and craft that he keeps that character so much more than just, you know, the external Robert Evans that we know and love. He makes him so much more deeper and layered than that.
No, you nailed it. It makes you think of what Laurence Olivier said. Sometimes you're doing acting from the outside in. Like, let's get the permatan. Let's get the 10 different pairs of glasses. Let's get the hair.
Yeah.
But the essence of Robert Evans, the fact he was a really smart, shrewd, cunning guy, and lovesick, heartbroken by Ally McGraw. Like, there's a real emotion to this guy beyond just the artifice.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, and this is you know, like I say, a testament to Matthew's great skill as an actor, that he takes every one of those moments and plays them with equal gusto and commitment, you know. He's not just reveling in the fun, you know, power stuff, but also the broken man who, has his heart broken by Ally McGraw. She ran off with Steve McQueen. I mean, you know, it's one of the great sort of, you know, love stories of Hollywood. But, you know, if you're going to get your heart broken, you know, you lose your girl who you love, the woman you love, when she runs off with Steve McQueen, how do you compete with that? You know, talking to great Hollywood icons like Mitchum, you know, this was Steve McQueen. And I think, you know, that Matthew really, really was diligent and careful and particular and passionate about it. And I think that shows in every scene that he's in.
Yeah, I read some stuff. There's a great article in the Hollywood Reporter about his work. I encourage everyone to check it out, in which he says that he had to listen to audio tapes of Robert Evans from that time. Because he said, if you watch The Kid Stays in the Picture, that's an older Robert Evans. You know, his voice is different and such. So he goes, I had to kind of get the voice from the early 70s and the cadence and just that delivery. It's a very kind of crisp, unique delivery, calling people babe and, you know, tossing up expressions. It's just, it's such a fun. I could imagine for you as a director, what was it like directing a performance like that? Would you ask him for more takes? Would you kind of just let him do his thing? How did you harness it?
Well, it was very well harnessed already. I mean, that is the beauty of it, because we had this rehearsal period and I asked everyone to create their backstory and their history and research their characters, if they were real people or if they were invented. You know, everyone had to create their entire history, and he had a wealth of material to dive into, because Evans documented a lot of his own life and was well documented. But still, the emotional journey of that character that he goes through this period, which was a really tumultuous period, but also a very exciting one, even in film terms, you know, what, you know, was happening between 68 to 72. You know, the whole landscape of movies was changing seismically, and he was a huge part of that. But I think Matthew found a way of listening to The Kid Stays in the Picture and understanding who that man was and trying to imagine who he was, you know, 40 years before that, how that energy was different, how that voice was different, how that younger man's cadence was. And this was, again, another huge part of what he did. But in terms of directing him, I would, you know, set him up and let it knock it down. And if there were certain beats or things that I thought that he could mine, or there was something that was coming further down the line that we could sort of set up, then we spoke about it. But it's one of the great joys of great acting is, you know, don't get in the way of it and only, you know, do what you can to support, encourage and give people confidence. That's my general rule of thumb.
That's very smart. We're talking to Dexter Fletcher. Once again, the offer is available on Paramount Plus. You should definitely check it out if you have not already. Anytime you're watching The Godfather, Dexter, you want to see how many seasons are they going to have from The Godfather, meaning here's Marlon Brando stroking the cat, right? Here's Al Pacino, the famous scene where he shoots Sollozzo. I mean, how much fun was it to recreate those scenes?
Well, I my first two episodes, I didn't get to do those scenes. That comes later on in the show, and they're beautifully realised. They're great, and I paid little homages to them. You know, I have Giovanni Ribisi playing Joe Colombo, and I have him at a particular moment where he's at a meeting with the heads of the five families, or two of them, and he goes into the restroom, and there's an old toilet there, and we pay homage in our own little cheeky way, you know, which is fun, but. Like I said, we can never replicate or, you know, we'd be foolish to chase trying to make The Godfather. And that's why if you look at the show, it rarely appears, or there's glimpses of it. You're on the sidelines, or even when you see people watching the film for the first time, you see the people watching it. You know, you see all these New York guys watching it. And because it's such a, it is a bit of a sacred cow in a way, if you like. You know, it seemed kind of, you know, sacrilegious, not sacrilegious, but kind of crazy to do it.
I adore Frank Sinatra. It was crazy to see in the movie, and I wasn't surprised by this. I'm like, I'm pretty sure he probably did not like the character of Johnny Fontaine, which very much felt based on Frank Sinatra, a guy, you know, tough guy, mob rules, you know, stuff. But the fact that he kind of intimidated Mario Puzo like that, that's been one of the best parts of your show. I'd watch it, and then I'd Google it and go, did this happen? Is this true? Yes, it did happen. Frank Sinatra did intimidate and bully Mario Puzo.
Yeah, and John Wayne was at the table that night as well. You know, that's another part of it that we couldn't really have. But John Wayne was at dinner with Sinatra, and Puzo came in and came over to pay his respects. And Sinatra went for him, you know, and Puzo defended himself with a fork. I mean, it's, you know, it's Hollywood legend, and it's brilliant. And yeah, we got to play all of that wonderful stuff and see these people in a different light, which we, you know, we really, really enjoyed. And we're very grateful to have that opportunity.
Tell me about the reception to the, I mean, listen, any Godfather fans like me have eaten up the show, but have you had the chance? Did Coppola reach out? Pacino? Anybody involved in the original Godfather? Has anyone passed along their thoughts?
No, I've not. I mean, I'd love to hear from Coppola, the great man himself. And I sat with Pacino because I was lucky enough to work with him as an actor. I played his son in a movie called Revolution.
Oh, yeah. 1985, Hugh Hudson, sure.
That's right. So I know Al from way back when. And I played his son, like I say. So I reached out to him here, and I knew that he was a big fan of Rocket Man. When I directed Rocket Man, we were on the circuit here in 2019, and Al was around with the Irishman, and we kept bumping into each other. He said, I love the movie, the Rocket Man movie. And he calls me my boy. It's so good. You've done amazing. He's like super proud, and I'm like, you know, over the moon that Al. And so when we were doing this, I went and sat with him and just sort of spoke to him about what he was like at that age and what his influences were and what that was. And we had coffee for an hour or so, and he talked really eloquently and beautifully about who he was at that time in his life, which I spoke to young Anthony about. And I'm hoping to see him. I'm now back in LA editing another project. So I've got a dinner coming up with Al in the next week or so. So hopefully I'll get to it. But I hear that he really likes it. I mean, I know that. I think he thinks it's great. I mean, one of the lovely things he's quoted as saying is that it really captures that period of filmmaking. And that, for me, is one of the greatest compliments, because that's really what we were reaching for. Is like, this was a really, like I was saying, a seminal time for movie making. You know, if you look at the films that we're making and the people who are making them, and it's a very short window. But the masterpieces that came out of that period and this time in Hollywood, you know, from Easy Rider to Paper Moon to Five Easy Pieces, you know, it's like the list is endless of this in this particular pocket of really Marathon Man and just like these incredible, incredible films and incredible artists to just be able to get to dip our toe in that and you know, tip our hat to those guys was really the joy of it.
Yeah, from 67 to 77, you can't beat it. Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, you name it.
It's crazy. It's crazy good.
Crazy good is also The Offer. Dexter Fletcher, phenomenal job. I love that story with you and Pacino. Hopefully you get to see him, and I'm sure he will tell you more how much he loved the show. But I encourage everyone to go check out the show on Paramount Plus, all 10 parts. I know the Emmy nominations. I'm sure you guys will get a ton of Emmy nominations, and you deserve it. And let me add by the fact, Rocket Man was terrific. And I was a little bit skeptical, Dexter, because I said, well, another musical biopic. I don't know a whole lot about Elton John. And I thought it was fabulous. Start to finish, it was creative and stylish, and it was really, really well done. I
appreciate it.
I was singing the songs afterwards. That's how well it does. So
well, great. I appreciate it, man. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. Well, it's great to talk to a genuine enthusiast and fan like yourself as well. You know, your energy is infectious. So thank you.
No, that's so kind of you, Dexter. Be well.
All right. And you.
All right. Thanks so much. Once again, Dexter was awesome. You heard at one point he said we had a major Hollywood star there who was going to be Robert Evans. And once the interview was over, I said to him, hey, listen, I know Armie Hammer was supposed to be the main lead, and then Miles Teller jumped in. That was reported. I know you didn't want to say it, but just between us, can you tell me? And he did tell me. So that just shows what a good guy Dexter Fletcher is. I'll tell you off here. I can't tell anybody right now. He told me the story, and he goes, yeah, this just stays between us. I'm like, no, I appreciate that. But it was recording via Zoom. The fact he trusted me, that shows Dexter's a good man. Thanks once again to him and his reps and the entire team. Make sure you check out The Offer on Paramount Plus. Make sure you check out Dan as Elvis. Amazing. And this was a blast. Hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. We will talk to you next time on Cinephile. Lots of movies coming out. Minions, The Rise of Gru. I think next week, more Michael Keaton. I want to do Batman Returns. More Michael Keaton, more Tim Burton. I'll see you at the movies.